wanted to say a lot more, to cover a lot more ground. Let me state briefly my critique of liberalization. That is, liberalization in general. The assumption of liberalization is fivefold. There are five assumptions. The first is a political one, that a market liberal regime unconstrained by political factors is in fact feasible. That's the first assumption. Second assumption is trickle down, that in fact elite incentives are what drive economic growth. If you take care of the elite, the rest will be taken care of in good time. In fact, what's good for the elite is what's good for the masses. Third, the assumption on coordination. Liberalization assumes that the market can fully coordinate the decisions of isolated individuals, consumers, firms, and so on. The state can only get in the way of the market coordinating the economy. Fourth is the assumption of substitutability. That is, liberalizers generally assume that private and public investment are alternatives. They are substitutes. If the government invests more, it'll drive up the interest rates and dampen private investment, and vice versa. But there's an alternative argument, and that is the argument of complementarity. When the government invests more in power and roads, better highways, better railways, and so on, it will actually crowd in rather than crowd out private investment. But this is an argument that liberalizers studiously avoid. Fifth is the assumption on technology. Liberalizers have great faith in free trade, level playing field or not. They believe that the technology market itself is approximately a competitive market, which of course we know is not true. The last thing that moves freely in a market is knowledge. And the technology market is one of the most non-competitive markets in the world. But no, say the liberalizers, you can get free trade working in technology and you can get convergence. So these are the assumptions of the liberalizers. And there are counter arguments to every one of these positions. Since I'm really going over the time, I'll have to be very, very brief. My counter-arguments are not necessarily related to the five assumptions directly, one-to-one, but let me raise those points. First, the real distinction ought to be between comparative advantage and competitive advantage. Liberalizers only concentrate on comparative advantage. Comparative advantage means if you're good at cutting wood, you should cut wood. If I'm good at producing computers, I should produce computers. And if you and I trade, we'll both be better off. Fair enough. But comparative advantage is not a static thing. It changes. Somebody who cuts wood today may have the potential to be a great computer scientist tomorrow. The question is, should he spend some time becoming a computer scientist? That is not answered by the theory of comparative advantage. In fact, in the present context, freer trade will mean that many of our enterprises and sectors and industries and so on will gravitate towards where we have an advantage. And where do we have an advantage? We have an advantage in cheap labor. But cheap labor is a symptom of underdevelopment. It is not the basis for development. In fact, I can easily envisage a situation where, with liberalized external markets, we end up having many more industries like the carpet industry in India, based on child labor, or like the garment industry in Bangladesh. Is that a sign of strength? I doubt it. So what is strength? What is international comparative strength? Well, it's not comparative advantage. It is what, for want of a better word, I would call competitive advantage. You must globalize in the sense that you must always try to measure up to the world if you want to be efficient. The reason is, if you don't measure up to the world, you will be better off importing the relevant stuff. There's no question about that. You can't deny that logic. But you must also have competitive strength, which is based on technology, which is based on real strength, not weakness. And comparative strength is not necessarily going to be promoted by a free trade doctrine. It's going to be developed only by painstaking efforts at many different levels. I'm going to be very, very short, so I'll leave it at that. I could elaborate that. The second point I want to make is the importance of the home market. People keep talking about the importance of the export markets. The home market is very important. The home market is very important for three good reasons. First, if you have a large home market, such as we do in India, many industries which require large plants, large scale of operations, can in fact be supported because we have a large market. Second, the home market is a fundamental factor in inducing investment. Entrepreneurs are not automatons, as our textbooks of economics suggest. Entrepreneurs are human beings, and they are social beings. They are influenced by each other. If the neighboring entrepreneur is pessimistic, I become pessimistic. If he's optimistic, I become optimistic. You can see this in the stock market. And as such, entrepreneurs need some good reason to invest. And an act of investment is not easy. Because the payoffs come, think of a steel plant, the payoffs come 50 years from now. It's almost a gambling decision to invest in modern industry. The buoyancy of domestic demand, of the domestic market, can give the confidence that entrepreneurs need to invest. And the more they invest, the better the economy grows. The third reason is having a home market can provide a good base for diversification of risks. You want our industries to develop their technology, they've got to invest in R&D. But they will not normally invest in R&D by hoping that on the basis of that R&D, they'll come up with technologies which will then capture European markets. They better hope that they can capture some portion of the Indian market. So the domestic market is very important for all these three reasons. I think the free trade doctrine exaggerates the importance of trade. The third point that I want to make is the role of public investment. There are two types of infrastructure, hard infrastructure and soft infrastructure. On the hard side, you have power, transport, communications, and in case of agriculture, irrigation. On the soft side, you have education, health, and research. A poor country would not be a poor country if it had good, hard, and soft infrastructure. One of the defining characteristics of a poor country is poor infrastructure, hard as well as soft. But these are areas in which the private sector has a great deal of trouble getting into. There are all kinds of reasons which I can go into, but I will not for want of time. The fourth area is the financial system. The liberalizers consider financial reforms as producing a level playing field between the government and the private sector, and between different parts of the private sector. But let's face it, there never is going to be a level playing field between the peasant and the Tatas. There's never going to be a level playing field between a small manufacturer and the Tatas. And I don't see why, if there are social priorities, if there are good reasons to develop certain sectors of the economy, and there are always are good reasons. In the next 10, 15 years, employment is not going to be our strong point, I don't believe. Therefore, it seems to me that promoting labor-intensive industries, promoting the unorganized sector, will be part or should be part of our employment strategy. But how do you promote these sectors unless you make sure they have financing? Credit is a major constraint. The search for a level playing field in the financial system may also be illusory. So for all of these reasons, I would suggest, not that liberalizers are wrong, that I'm leaving it to a discussion for tomorrow, and not in general, but in the Indian context, because that's where we are going to discuss, evaluate, and then consider alternatives. My point is, in the knowledge business, sometimes you find that he that screams the most is believed to have the most knowledge. But this may be false. Often the people who do not say very much may not say very much because they believe that you cannot say very much. And to be frank with you, while I've marshaled several arguments against the liberalizers, I have several doubts, both about the the goodness of liberalization and its badness. I think economists, like all knowledge workers, hate to confess to their limitations. But people find out tomorrow how far we can push these arguments and reach concrete decisions. Because I do not want to leave you with the impression now that this sort of general discussion is the end of the story. Because I hope that tomorrow we will actually get away from this with some idea of what can be done, what should be done, and so on. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Mohan. Now the topic is discussion, open for discussion.
We'll begin. There's really only two items that I want to take up. One is stock taking of where we are today. The other is to indicate new directions in both strategic and policy terms. These new directions overlap with the current policy prescriptions that are being followed, but they also deviate, and I will indicate the extent and nature of deviations. I shall try to finish up in about 40, 45 minutes, and following that, we will have an open house, and I think we should have it free format, but all of us should exercise individual restraint so that everybody gets a chance. There's an advantage in the free format, and that is we can have back and forth discussions, and we can continue with the discussion on a given topic without getting lost across many different topics. We can concentrate, then move on. I'll provide some direction as we go along. First, for the stock taking, what have been the achievements of liberalization to date? First of all, the inflation rate is down, at least from the 91 level, which was 16.5%. It's running at about 8% today. Secondly, foreign exchange reserves are running at about $7 billion, which is about 4 or 5 times where we were in 1991. There has been a rise in direct foreign investment, which is running at about $500 million per annum presently. And since 91, there has been a cumulative accretion of $3.5 billion worth of foreign investment approvals, which is not the same thing as realizations. Fourth, the fiscal deficit is down from 8.5% to 5.7%. Part of this is because of some reduction in current expenditures. The main part of it, unfortunately, has come from scaling down public investment. So it's an achievement with a dark lining. And finally, imports have been down, and exports have risen quite smartly in the past 2 years. But the current account deficit remains still. And it is possible that with the devaluation's effects eroding with inflation, that imports will once again start rising at customary rates, in which case we may have a shaky external situation once more. Now, what's behind the numbers? Is inflation really low? Well, as I pointed out yesterday, an 8% rate of inflation is not high, but it is not low either. So getting it further down would be an important necessary condition for successful reforms. What about growth performance? Well, in the first year of reforms, we had a 1% GDP growth. This past year, we have had a 4% GDP growth. Government tells us that In the current year, the rate of growth would be 5%. But a great deal of this 4 and 5% numbers have hinged upon good monsoons. That could also be said for the decline in the inflation rate. The Indian economy has had particularly good luck in the past 6-7 years with the rain gods. And what these numbers do not tell us, but other numbers do tell us, is that industrial growth has slackened enormously. Industrial investment has also slackened enormously. Private investment more so than public investment. But this is to be expected, in part because of the recession. But it remains to be seen when and how speedily we'll get out of the recession. The improvement in reserves is comforting, but a great deal of it has come from new borrowings, particularly from the international banks, including the Asian Development Bank and the Monetary Fund. There has been some slight improvement in reserves, which can be attributed to the changing export and import ratios. So not all of the increase in reserves is because of additional borrowings, but a good bit of it is because of that. In fact, presently we are running at about $85 billion of total external debt. That is up from the level that we were at in 1991. We have, of course, opened up our economy. Tariff rates are down. But many of our industrialists and the capital goods sector in particular have been complaining about dumping. They've been complaining about anomalies in the tariff structure. There's also been concern about the problems of financing the infrastructure sectors, in particular the power sector. There has been controversy over what Sharad Pawar and his government have been doing in this area. And this is indeed a black cloud. I'm not optimistic that the process of privatization of the power sector, so long as politics goes on as usual, is going to take place in the best interests of the nation. Government has also been giving tax concessions to foreign investment. It has also allowed the rise of multinational control over subsidiary companies by allowing them to have a stake of 51%, and many multinationals have taken quick advantage of this and have indeed acquired controlling interests in many of these companies. And it's remarkable that 9 out of 10 or 19 out of 20 of these changes have occurred in consumer goods industries. It's a symptom of what direct foreign investment is really about. If it wants to invest in this country, it wants to invest in consumer goods markets, which are oriented to the upper end of the economy in terms of incomes. If it wants to invest in the infrastructure sectors, then it wants all sorts of guarantees, high rates of return, etc., etc. In other words, when it comes to goods that we really don't need, that we can do without, multinationals appear to be over-enthusiastic about giving us those goods. When it comes to stuff that we really need, their enthusiasm is much more dampened. And what we're in fact seeing by way of technology inflows appears, I mean, I've not done any serious analysis of this, but the general press stories appear to give the impression that there's a lot of new investment in low and intermediate technologies that foreign companies are willing to do, and there is a bias in their willingness to come in with new technologies. Now, the most uncharitable description of the liberalization policy would be to say that it is anti-small scale, that it is anti-employment, that it is anti-poor, and that it is anti-environment. Continuing this description, we could also say that it is pro-TNC, that is transnational corporations, that it is pro-large firms, and that it is pro-middle class. Now, this would be the pessimistic view of the emerging scenario. The optimistic view of the emerging scenario would be that all of the above might be true, but only temporarily so. That in good time, the Indian economy as a whole will benefit. The poor, the unemployed, the unorganized, the rural, and also the middle class. But there are a few points I should like to mention which seem to incline me in the pessimistic direction. Not wholly, but to incline me in that direction. Financial liberalization threatens to pull the rug from under the small-scale sector. I worry about this. I worry about the employment implications of this. I also worry about export prospects, because the truth of the matter is our large companies have not been particularly export-oriented. Neither, as I've already indicated, are the old and the incoming transnational corporations particularly inclined to export. In fact, a lot of our exports come from our small-scale and unorganized sectors. So I worry about what we are doing in the name of financial liberalization. Of course, I also worry about closures, sickness, and exit. Present estimates are that we will one way or another have to get rid of about 5 million workers in the organized sector. Even at 1 lakh rupees compensation apiece, that works out to 50,000 crores, which is about 6-7% of GNP. I don't see the National Renewal Fund. I think that runs at about 3,000 crores. At that rate, it'll take us 17 years to get rid of the overhang of employment. There have also been real cuts in social expenditures, education and health, taken together. And the terms of privatization, the terms for foreign investment in infrastructure, etc., also augur poorly for the Indian economy, because these will all be cost inflating. These factors will all inflate our costs. And when infrastructure prices rise unnecessarily, this is going to cascade throughout the economic system, producing inflation. Now, reservations have been expressed about liberalization, so to speak, from the inside. And these relate to 3 points: sequencing, transition time, and uncertainty. Many economists, even those who are very, very sympathetic to liberalization, have argued that ideally we should have restored the fiscal balance first and then taken up domestic market liberalization and then allowed exposure to international competition, international capital, etc. We have got all of these things coming at the same time. Another question of sequencing is that we ought to have reduced our balance of payments deficit first and then resorted to reductions in export protection. Unfortunately, these measures have also come in one fell swoop. I think the only explanation for this that I can think of is a political one. Our policymakers have been in a hurry to rush things through before the door gets shut once again. And they may have a logic in doing so. But in economic terms, the logic is lacking. Transition time. Now, I've already indicated yesterday that there are sound arguments to be at least skeptical about the growth gains from liberalization. But nobody would deny that there is going to be a transition period. This may last from 3 to 10 years, during which stabilization has to be completed, basic policy changes have to be implemented, and structural changes must occur in the desired directions. All of these things will take time. Finally, uncertainty. The uncertainty attaches particularly to export growth. Export growth will depend on the condition of the world market, and that is a very difficult thing to forecast. It would depend on inflation performance within our economy. If inflation shoots up, then our competitiveness will decline. And if we try to make that up with devaluations, then our inflation will shoot up again. So we'll keep chasing our own tails. And there will have to be considerable effort that our entrepreneurs have to devote to switching markets from the domestic market to foreign markets. This is not an easy task. The whole world is trying to export more. We are not the only people who are trying to export more. So there's a lot of uncertainty. And finally, there is a lot of unfinished business. Reforms, as I said yesterday, are only halfway through. And the remaining half, many people would argue, and I agree, the remaining half might be quite possibly much more painful than the half that we have completed. There are reservations which one could also enter from the outside, so to speak. The first reservation that I have is that reforms have been excessively externally oriented. And one could argue that this is a necessary consequence of bank fund tutelage to the reforms. I also worry about the excessive orientation towards foreign direct investment and technology imports. In certain areas, these imports are critical. In other areas, they are redundant or worse. Now, our policymakers, in the haste to adopt an unrestrained liberal attitude towards foreign trade, foreign investment, and foreign capital, appear to have abandoned any notion of strategic direction to the economy. And when you pursue this sort of neutrality, while you might satisfy textbook economists, and you might satisfy the bank and the fund, you might very well end up compromising your own priorities. I already mentioned yesterday that exports are likely to become the favored child of the Indian economy. And I don't think that that's a very good idea necessarily. There are also limits of privatization. Privatization to raise funds is necessary. Privatization to get rid of enterprises which the government is not managing very well is also necessary. But there's very little real action when it comes to public sector reforms. I don't see much happening on that count. And unless we do that, we will quickly run into diminishing returns in the privatization process. There are profitable public enterprises, but there's a much longer tail distribution of unprofitable enterprises. These enterprises have physical assets, but they also have human liabilities. They have large compensations to pay, as I've already indicated, in the 50,000 crores number. So it is far from clear to me that merely looking at the book values of our public enterprises and deriving optimism from that is going to really help. So privatization is going to run into diminishing returns, because sooner or later the private sector is going to find that rather than expend its marginal rupees on buying up public enterprises, it's better off investing in new enterprises. So there is a clear lack of direction on both management and ownership structure. in directing the organized sector of this economy. Again, it reflects, it seems to me, a strategic vacuum which has been filled, unfortunately, by liberal formulas. Finally, there is a general neglect of the unorganized sectors. Agriculture has done well, seemingly done well in the 80s, going by the growth rates of output. But it has done very poorly, going by the growth rates of investment. Through the 80s, both public and private investment have fallen sharply. And it is entirely possible that the impact of this slowing down of public investment and private investment in agriculture will show up in the next 10 years. So it would seem that the market formula for agriculture, which in fact some quarters of government are pushing, is also going in the wrong direction. It is wishful thinking, as far as I can tell. Finally, with respect to the 90% of our workers in the organized sector, there's a woeful inadequacy of safety nets, of social spending, etc. This is an internal contradiction, although the criticism is external. It's an internal contradiction because no economic policy is going to succeed if it is not politically sensible. People keep talking endlessly about the 120 million and the 150 million of the middle class. But for heaven's sake, there's 750 million remaining population. 6:1 is the ratio. How can the middle class go it alone? What sorts of political alliances are they expecting to have? And how can they have those political alliances unless they can take some of the issues just raised seriously? Now, are there lessons to draw? I would like to point up three lessons. Now, some of you may have some difficulty in seeing exactly how I arrive at these lessons from the past 2 days of my talks. But suffice it to say that the connections can in fact be established. And if you have questions about this, we can take it up in the discussion as well. The first lesson is that the state still has to play very important functions in our economy. Whether we like it or not, whether socialism is dead or not, the state is here to stay for many good and important reasons. The other side of this lesson is that the soft state and corrupt politics are still with us. They're very much alive. In fact, they might even be growing. And what this second lesson, the second side of this lesson means is that we should no longer repose much faith in our state apparatus, in running efficient delivery systems, or in tackling the problems of efficiency. In other words, the state will have to continue to play important functions, but its wings will have to be clipped in the areas of production, direct delivery systems, and other issues where efficiency considerations are of paramount importance. In other words, I'm asking for less state. The second lesson, the private sector quite clearly has got to play a major role in commodity production and in export growth. So that will be its important function. But it remains very weak on the technology front and on the employment generation front. What this means is that the private sector will address problems of growth and exports, but it will not solve the basic problems of the mass of the Indian population, at least not for the next 10, 15, 20 years. In other words, the standard debate about economic policy, which still remains hung up on the public versus private sector issue, is not a very fruitful debate. One is inclined to join Shakespeare and say, a plague on both your houses. Now, in the light of what we have discussed about the Indian economy's current situation and problems and past experience, let me identify some key areas which need immediate and long-term attention. First area is infrastructure. Our power deficit in percentage terms is going to be larger in 2000 AD than it is today. Not smaller, even with the most optimistic plans of investment. So infrastructure is going to be a major concern. Second, our basic needs are a major concern. I think it's shameful that India, after 40 years, and with all that promise, has still very little to show to its masses in terms of satisfying their basic needs. Third, I'm pessimistic on the employment front. However well our exports do, however labor-intensive our exports are, we have a backlog of about 25 million unemployed. We have an annual rate of increase of 6 million to the labor force. So by 2000, we are talking about 50 to 60 to 70 million new jobs to be created, not counting the people who are seasonally unemployed, underemployed, etc., etc. A related point, of course, is that our safety nets are full of holes, as Dr. Antia pointed out yesterday. The fourth area of concern is private consumption. Now, in the liberal agenda, private consumption is all of consumption. Because everything is privatized, everything is purchased, healthcare is privatized, education is privatized. Needless to say, bread and jam are also privatized. So private consumption is all of consumption. This we must reject, not only because it is preposterous to suggest that all worthwhile goods and services can be marketized in a poor country like India, but also because even if in some areas this might be the case, we refuse to privatize. Why? Because privatization in some of these areas will produce enormous inequalities, enormous tensions. But private consumption is important. There's no denying. So I want to add private consumption as another area of concern. Now there are two other areas of concern. One is our debt to foreigners. The other is our debt to nature and our debt to future generations. The first is our foreign debt problem. The second is our ecological problem. The debt service burden is pretty high, as you know. This means that we must earn more and more foreign exchange in order to pay off the debts. This is a burden. It's a burden without any benefits whatsoever. Except that the benefits might be that no gunboats will arrive on the scene and we will not become an international pariah, we will not be thrown out of the IMF, the GATT, the World Bank, and so on and so forth. If you consider those to be benefits, yes, paying off these debts are a benefit. But there are no more benefits other than those. The debt to nature and the debt to future generations must also be repaid. They can only be repaid by repairing the environment. They can only be repaid by regenerating the environment. And the environment is not costless. Repairing and regenerating the environment is not costless. But by the same token, failing to repair or regenerate the environment is very costly. Whether it's air pollution or water pollution, whether it is running out of forests, or whether it is the siltation of our dams, or the overflow of our rivers across their basins. These problems, in fact, show up as economic costs.
When you fall sick and fail to attend your office or your factory, production is lost to the economy. When somebody dies, production is lost to the economy. There is such a thing as a value for life. When our dams last 25 years instead of 50 years, what happens to your cost-benefit analysis, which you undertook 25 years earlier? So repairing the ecological problems is good for us and good for the future. It's good for the economy as well. This is not to say that there is no trade-off between nature and man. There is a trade-off. It is only to say that what appears invisible might nonetheless be very real. And if you don't put your money there, then you're making bad trade-offs with nature. So with this in mind, I have briefly drawn up these two charts which I've distributed. So let me quickly go through those. The first one refers to processes, what needs to be done. And I've divided up the economy into four parts: the public sector, the private organized, the private unorganized, which includes agriculture, by the way. Private unorganized includes agriculture. And the cooperative sector, or the panchayati raj sector, or the village sector, depending on the language that you prefer. Or the Gandhian sector, if you like. What should the public sector do for us? I think the public sector has a big job on its hands tackling the problems of our infrastructure areas. Power, communications, transportation, irrigation. These are big enough subjects for the government to tackle. And they should be tackled well. The second goal for the state is to provide strategic direction for the economy as a whole. Strategic direction does not require armies of bureaucracy. Strategic direction does not require a delivery system. Strategic direction requires good politics, good bureaucrats, and good technocrats. It requires a heavy dose of public debate, which has been sadly lacking in the past 2 years, in spite of the fact that we've been asked to accept radical reforms of our economic system. The tools for achieving these would be, first and foremost, creating a system of autonomy and accountability, not through gimmicks such as MOUs, you know, MOUs, MOUs, Memoranda of Understanding, between ministers and chief executives of public sector companies. They don't mean very much. You mean very much not by saying things, but by meaning it. We need to carry out pricing reforms throughout the public sector, but particularly in the areas of irrigation and power. These will not be easy to come by. We can discuss the political assumptions underlying all of these proposals separately. The third is to enunciate a strategic industrial policy, by which I simply mean that we cannot do everything. Nobody can do everything. No economy can produce everything. And be good at all of them. You should concentrate on areas where you can become good. Not just good, that you can become masters. Not just masters, but you can become innovators. You can sell the technology to the rest of the world. We should identify areas in which we will be net exporters of technology. That should be the criterion of success. That is the East Asian path. Needless to say, we have to step up our expenditure on R&D, and clean up our
technology policy and research and development policies and administration. Yesterday, I was told by one of our friends here that we are spending 83%, I thought it was 70%, of our total R&D budget in this country in the public sector, 83%. The private sector spends only 17%. Much of this 83% is absorbed by the staff budgets, so much so that there is not even money left for consumables. So even the 83% that we are spending is not being well utilized because there's not enough money. And I can tell you the remaining 17% itself is of doubtful value. I've got a pharmacist friend in the Bombay pharmaceutical industry who tells me that a good bit of research, so-called research, in the multinational pharmaceutical companies in this country are hollow. The real research takes place in Switzerland or Germany or elsewhere. The private organized sector. The key goal there is that it should drive industrial growth and produce exports. These should be the criteria for evaluating our private organized sector. We must reward some companies, we must punish others. Now, this is a disastrous proposal in our political context. So please do not bring in the political context again. We can discuss that separately. But we must have a reward and punishment policy. And the tools here are to select enterprises and industries which, by their track record and future promise, reveal the greatest potential for rapid productivity growth and for rapid technological advance. Privatization. A certain amount of privatization, including in the infrastructure sectors, appears to be called for at the present juncture for two reasons. One is that we are quickly running up against serious constraints in the infrastructure sector. This is the supply side. The second problem is the financing problem. The government of India is broke, or nearly so. And financing problems loom large. So to that extent, we'll have to rely on the private sector, which is not to say that the private sector can do it on its own. Even in the power sector, you will find that the private and public will have to join hands together. And the private sector, private enterprise will have to be regulated. Again, politics comes into the picture. If you have a super highway between Bombay and Delhi and give the construction of that highway and the management of the highway and the collection of tolls to a private company, what is the price the company is going to charge? How much is the investment the company is going to make? Who is going to make out that the investment was not too much? Who's going to find out that the price is not too much? You've got to regulate. But can you regulate honestly? Not in the current political situation. So again, keeping the politics out, you can privatize infrastructure, provided you have an honest government. Turning to the private unorganized sector, the primary goals here are employment and saving foreign exchange, or earning foreign exchange. The tools are credit planning. I think we must use the banking system as we have used it in the past, but more efficiently and in a less politicized way. Credit is a powerful tool of economic policy, and there is no reason why we should be persuaded by the World Bank or by the Fund to sacrifice this powerful tool. We must also create industrial districts in which the principle should be cooperation and competition at the same time. I want to leave this aside. There's been a great deal of writing in the past 10 years, both in the West and now in the beginning stages for the third world as well, on so-called flexible specialization. And flexible specialization is something that some people believe India has a good potential for with the right kinds of policies, including industrial training and the creation of industrial districts. So a certain amount of public inputs but also a lot of private cooperation. Finally, turning to the biggest task, and that is the village or cooperative sector. The main functions of this sector would be to satisfy basic needs of the bulk of our population, to take care of the environment, local environmental problems, not of course global environmental problems or India-wide problems, and to tackle the problem of employment where it occurs, when it occurs, which is in the rural areas first. The village sector will plan, will identify priorities, will generate internal resources and also get public subsidies, and most important of all, deliver the relevant goods and services. They'll provide for health, for family planning, for education, for roads, for irrigation on a local basis, for water harvesting, for sanitation, for clean water, and the like. So it will be a combination of both basic needs and productive infrastructure. Things that directly make people better off, and things that also make them better workers, that also improve the value of their productive assets. And the tools, decentralization. This has been talked about a great deal for the past 10 years. It's time to see some action. There's a big question mark here, and that is the fact that our rural areas are not paragons of equality. They're areas of great inequality, of feudal attitudes, of the big men bossing the small men, of extreme inequalities of asset ownership and so on. This, of course, has always been a big question mark in India. The village box here is somewhat more radical than the Chinese model of development before 1980. It's a little bit more ambitious. And the Chinese model, I think, succeeded in large part because of land reforms. So I'm keeping both my eyes open here. I do foresee problems in the functioning of our village economies under a decentralized system when you give them lots of resources. But we have reached the end of the road. We must try something. And why not this one? Obviously, if you can get asset ownership changed, so much the better. On the next page, I talk about allocations in quotation marks. I've not done too much homework on this table, so don't hold me to it, please. But the homework can be done, and these numbers can be solidified. In particular, I make no distinction between current expenditure and investment expenditure. I've played around with numbers only this morning, so you have to take this table with a pinch of salt. But it gives you a rough idea of the changes that the strategy or the plan proposes. In the columns, you have the four sectors: the public, the private organized, the private unorganized, and the cooperative sectors. The last column indicates changes. In the rows, you have the main needs that I've identified: infrastructure, basic needs, environment, employment and safety nets, and private consumption. The numbers can be roughly thought of as reflecting our current investment priorities, current investment allocations. And our current investment is running at about 20%. The first row in each of the main rows refers to current allocation. For example, infrastructure, the public sector absorbs 5%. No infrastructure, I mean approximately, is produced in the private sectors or in the cooperative sector. The second row in that same main row indicates the new allocations. First of all, note that I'm proposing that infrastructure's share be increased from 5% to 6%, and that the public sector share be reduced from 5% to 4%. That what remains, namely 2%, be made up by the private sector. In the basic needs area, I'm proposing a doubling of our total allocations. Presently, approximately, I would say the public sector takes in 2%, the private sector takes in 1%. The public sector is trimmed by a half, the private sector remains where it is, the cooperative sector gets 4%. In other words, the cooperative sector will grow by more than overall growth in this area. On the environmental front, I think 1% is an over-optimistic number as to what our current expenditures are. I think the 8th plan has something like 1,000 crores on a per annum basis going to the environment ministry. But the environment is not tackled only under the so-called environment head. It's tackled in a variety of ways throughout the economy. And so our accounting may not capture all that. So let's take it at 1%. And I suggest that we increase it by 2% and all of it go into the cooperative sector. We'll still need the allocation at the central and state levels, of course. On employment and safety nets, I propose an overall scaling down by 1%. Why? Because basic needs and environmental expenditures should contribute directly to providing safety nets and employment. So I scale down the public sector to 1/3. The private unorganized sector will get 1%, for example, via credit subsidies. And the cooperative sector also will have nothing on this account directly. So there'll be a net reduction, net saving of 1%. In private consumption, I propose no change at all. No change, no increase, and no reallocations either. What you then get is overall an increase of 25% in total outlays, 5/20. Basic needs and environment getting the lion's share of those increases, infrastructure getting some increase, and employment programs facing a cut. On the sectoral side, the public sector is scaled down, let's see, by 4, 5, 7, 12. Public sector is scaled down by 1/3. The private organized sector rises by 2%. I don't know what the ratio is. The private unorganized by 1%, and the cooperative sector rises by infinite percent because it rises from 0 approximately to 6. Notice that this does not mean that the economy is becoming less socialist, if that is a concern for any of you. But the cooperative sector may be thought of as very much a socialist sector. Now, of course, I could, you know, we could go very much more into the details of the cooperative sector, because that's where a lot of the discussion ought to be, because that's one of our priorities. But I think we should also discuss infrastructure, the environment, and basic needs. But we can discuss anything you like.
Professor Rao, on conclusion of the series of 4 talks which you have given to all of us, it is my pleasure and privilege to convey our thanks to you. India, being a land of contradictions and contrasts, it is not very surprising that we find so complicated and confusing trends in our economy. But your presentation of the intricacies of the Indian economy in a very candid and interesting way has really impressed us all. During the course of 4 profound lectures, followed by very lively discussions, and also during our informal conversations outside this hall, we have had the benefit of your learned views on various economic subjects. Now we understand and appreciate our economy's past performance, present predicament, and future prospects. We all share your views, if I may say, pessimism regarding our economy because of the enormous problems of heavy debt burden, depletion of natural resources, particularly forests, and the growth of population. We hope that the country will be able to cope with these problems and we will have better days in the future. It was not an easy task to cover all aspects of Indian economy in just 4 talks, but you not only covered the subjects in depth, but also put them in proper global perspective. This was expected because of your knowledge of the impact of international institutions and pressures, as well as economic of some other major countries. On behalf of all participants in this study group, I convey our great appreciation and thanks to you, Professor Rao, for being with us during these 4 days and sharing your profound views on different aspects of Indian economy. Thank you.